This is Resonance 104.4 FM. She's gone, and I have to say, yes, it's just after midday, ladies and gentlemen. Although, it's not the middle of the day for many of us. Our Sunday has only just started, full of promise, hope and expectation. But the only people for whom midday is the middle of the day are the kind of people who get up at 4 a.m. and go to bed at 8 p.m., which I suppose means shift workers, breakfast DJs and the elderly. If you fall into any one of those three categories, welcome to the show. And if you don't, welcome to the show. This is the time-wasting radio show, and our penultimate programme looks set to break new records this week for the longest-running radio show to feature myself, Rodri Marsden, in charge of what gets played and when. In fact, the iron rod with which I rule this show has become slightly bent over the last fortnight. I just wheeled it so strongly, you see, and it wasn't a particularly expensive iron rod, just one I picked up for a few quid on QVC, the chopping channel. To tell you the truth, it's barely usable, so for this week alone, I'll be ruling this show with a rod of tanzanite with a rose quartz and pink sapphire inset, along with a 0.84 carat amethyst diamond accent. But enough about orbs and scepters, let's find out what you have to look forward to in today's show. We'll be hearing records from all over Europe, by which I mean artists from all over Europe, not a Doobie Brothers record sent in by a listener in Luxembourg. My Resonance FM guru, Tim Steiner, will be here in the studio in a few minutes or so in a desperate attempt to persuade me that the music he played on his show is better than the music I play on mine. So things could get a bit aggressive and unpleasant. We'll have Sport with Steve Graziak, Thought for the Week with Neil Scott, a roundup of the political landscape with Andrew Ward, and a live performance from the Moet et Chandon of the poetry world, or should that be Poet et Chandon, Rogan Whitenails. Now, amidst all the Toto, Kenny Loggins and Steely Dan I managed to surreptitiously sneak onto this show, it's pretty easy to lose sight of the fact that I like nothing more than to be viciously pummeled by vicious guitar work, rumbling bass, machine gun drumming, and an enormous man dressed up in rubber gear screaming his head off over the top. So what better time to remind you all of this with a tune at the top of the show to get you all warmed up and ready for this feast of entertainment that awaits you over the next 90 minutes. So, lock up your chubby sons, ladies and gentlemen. Here are DeSalvo. Yeah! That was the brutal onslaught of DeSalvo, and they're playing at the Water Rats in London on January the 28th with Stars in Battle Dress, who were last week's guests, and Keith John Adams, who was the guest on week one. And I've put them all on myself at Water Rats and paid money as a deposit for a gig. So you must go. One of the stranger things that's happened since starting this radio show was getting put in touch with a radio production company who were working on John Ronson's new series on Radio 4. I was asked if I had any thoughts on three particular topics: building bridges, waiting, and outstaying your welcome. I penned a few bon mots, that's good words in French, and sent them off. My thoughts on outstaying one's welcome were deemed good enough to use, but sadly Mr. Ronson then decided that the topic of friends, i.e. chums or pals, not the TV series, would make a better topic than outstaying one's welcome, and so I was unceremoniously dropped. Resonance FM, however, doesn't have quite as strict a quality control department, as you can tell, because I'm on here now. So, myself and a few friends ruined the summer of 1992 for an American man called Gary Beach. We were in a band called the Keatons and had embarked on one of the first tours by an indie band behind the old Iron Curtain. We crammed ourselves into a tiny van and made our way slowly across Europe, hindered by lack of funds and a particularly annoying drummer. When we reached the shattered chemical-producing town of Usti nad Labem, we were grateful to encounter a friendly, English-speaking face belonging to a chap in one of the bands we were about to play with. "My name's Gary," he said. "Gary Beach, although I have to say Gary Beach to the Czechs, otherwise they can't spell it properly." We went on just before his band, in which he played slap bass while wearing a bandana and dark glasses. He mistook our shrieks of laughter for good-humoured support and invited us to stay at his flat. "For as long as you like," he said, not meaning it. Things began badly. On the night we arrived, Mo, our performance artist — it was that kind of band — lagged behind for a couple of hours and eventually turned up at the flat at 2 a.m. and couldn't find anywhere to sleep. So he kipped down by the front door. In the morning, after Gary had steadily tiptoed over all the rest of the band on his way to work, he tripped over Mo's legs and smashed his face into the back of the letterbox. He consoled himself with the knowledge that we would be on our way pretty soon. But no. Sadly for him, our tour revolved entirely around the shattered chemical-producing town of Usti nad Labem, and the meagre amount of money we were earning meant that we couldn't afford hotels. So we took Gary at his word. We were there, on and off, for about 2 weeks, and we began to have a detrimental effect on his health and sanity. In total, including him, there were 8 of us in a pretty small flat. Out of sheer necessity, we stole his food, ran up his phone bill, and woke him in the small hours of the morning with raucous laughter. We began to sense annoyance. One morning, he walked into the kitchen, bleary-eyed, in his underwear, a large erection forming an impressive tent in his pants. "Man," he wailed as he beat a hasty retreat, "I can't even walk around my flat with a hard-on anymore." And you'll notice that I've dropped the American accent I'd attempted earlier. In another memorable incident, our annoying drummer, the kind of man who is constantly hungry, was rooting through Gary's bedroom cupboards looking for food. He found a gigantic vibrator dildo contraption, which he examined, and when he established that he couldn't eat it, just put it down, not bothering to hide it back in the cupboard. One weekend in the middle of our stay, Gary couldn't take any more and packed his stuff in the car, telling us he was going to East Germany, where he no doubt found the radioactive slag heaps of Chemnitz preferable to another night with us. On his return, he was horrified to find that we were still there. A couple of days later, he started to get agitated because he was giving an English lesson and needed the flat to himself. We forgot about one of these English lessons and returned to the flat early one afternoon to find him in a compromising position with a young Czech girl, at which point he completely lost it. His frizzy hair shaking and eyes bulging, he ordered us out of the flat. We never went back to Usti nad Labem. That's all I have to say on the subject of Gary Beach. So let's play a piece of music by one of the bands with whom the Keatons played on that particular tour. De Kift are, or were, from the Netherlands and used to dress up in 1930s civilian clothes and perform their sets on a stage mocked up to look like a 1930s living room. Everything they sang was in Dutch, so I've no idea about the reasons behind this unusual method of presentation, but they were rather splendid. Here are De Kift. We'll be right back.
Maar loop in een kring tussen grijze muren. En de man die voor me loopt is al lang dood. Het is een nagemaakt mens. Want waarom moet hij voor me lopen en leven terwijl jonge mensen die nog niks van vliegen weten uit het dakgat in de dood storten, hè? Op zijn hielen en maak met mijn mond een afzichtelijk geluid alsof ik telkens een kwart pond longenhasje uit tegen zijn rug spuw. Dan ben je zo leeg van liefde dat de haat in je schuimt als champagne. En je laat hem schuimen door die verschrikkelijke leegte niet meer te voelen. En geloof me niet dat je met een lege maag en een leeg hart een neiging hebt om bijzondere staaltjes van mensenliefde te vertonen.
That was De Kift with the song Cryin' from the album Krankenhaus, which, as any student of Teutonic languages will know, means hospital. To my mind, there aren't enough concept albums about hospitals, or even songs about hospitals. In fact, the only one that springs to mind is the Manic Street Preachers' Roses in the Hospital, in which they sing, "Nothing really makes me happy, roses in the hospital, heroin is just too trendy." A lesson for us all there. This is the slot that they call arguing pointlessly about music, but which I call Prove Me Wrong. Each week I've invited on the programme someone who finds a particular artiste irresistible, while I, conversely, find them really rather resistible. This week, I'm overjoyed to have with me Tim Steiner, who presented the marvellous show Big Ears on Resonance, particularly marvellous despite the fact that I was on it every week. Tim, hello, and welcome to the show this afternoon.
Oh, good afternoon, Roger. Very nice to be in here, seeing the other side of the desk.
Now, yes, our positions are reversed, and
absolutely, yeah.
Do you feel a sense of power over me?
Not really.
That's the kind of the way our shows used to be.
Yeah.
I remember a particular show where I was very, very sullen and gave no feedback to you whatsoever.
Well, I recall it. You'd always be pretty chipper before you came in, and then the slightest thing could offset you the moment that you came in and sat down here. For example, I think there was a football game once, and there was on that one, somebody had scored something and switched you right off. You said maybe three or four words in the first hour of the show before buoying yourself up.
I know, and I apologise for that now, and I thank you for being slightly more verbose than I was.
It's absolutely fine.
We have this slot, Prove Me Wrong, and I didn't know what we were going to do, because on the Big Ears show there was such a wide range of music that I just really didn't like. I could have picked anything. I picked Nam June Paik out of a very, very long list, purely, I don't know why, I quite like his name, I think.
Nam June Paik says he's kind of a great choice, because out of all of the stuff that I've played on the show, I played a couple of tracks of Nam June Paik, largely because Sub Rosa issued a long overdue and very excellent compilation of some early electronic pieces of his. But of course, Nam June Paik is primarily not known as a sound artist, but
no.
A video and installation artist, in which field he is as important as anyone. And I think, you know, it's fair to say that without his pioneering work in the mid-late 60s and early 70s, video installation art would not be what it is today.
Okay.
He broke lots of frontiers there. And his purely tape and sound pieces are actually They're of most interest because of the way that they inform us about his later video and installation work. Now, if you're more ignorant of his video and installation work, then the sound pieces might wash over you. So, in fact, it's a very difficult thing to do on the radio, because to get any real sense of the importance and excellence of these early electronic pieces, which were done when he was in his late 20s, you need to go out and have a look at an exhibition. And at the moment, the only exhibition I know of is at the Guggenheim in Manhattan.
Should we go?
Okay, let's go.
Okay, thank you, Resonance listeners. See you next week.
Anyway, I brought in, I think, one Nam June Paik track. Now, this was when he was in Germany, and it was just after he encountered Stockhausen. And Stockhausen was actually only a few years older than him, but already a tremendous influence in the electronic music world. And he'd also met John Cage, and on the back of those two meetings, he started doing some really wild and crazy stuff and scaring the bejeebies out of all of them. And this is a very short electronic track that was discovered only in 1999.
Which track is it, Tim,
this
actually?
Is track three. This is track three. Simple, very short track.
Okay, here we go. That was very short.
Yeah, that's short. But of course, what you can hear in there is all the playfulness that he brought in with his video installation art later on. And also just the a very early example of the obvious use of speeded up popular music on electronic track, which became very popular in the mid-60s. This is recorded in 1961, and I'm at pains to think of an earlier example of it than that. So even at that early stage, really doing great things.
Okay. It's easy to accuse me of being just a philistine.
Yes.
Basically, I like nice tunes or music with a good beat. I suppose that's your basic...
Well, I think the thing was with the show that I always used to do was that if it was at fault in any way, which I think it probably wasn't, but if it was, the fault would be was that I tried to cater to too many tastes on it. Because, as you know, I like a good tune too.
Of course.
Perhaps not some of the tunes that you personally play.
We've got Kenny Loggins behind us at the moment.
Okay, yeah, well, precisely. And I'd enjoy playing Nam June Paik alongside Sol Hoopy, alongside the children's choir of Skravenat Skolikor. And it's that range of things that I used to really enjoy.
Can you remember something that I particularly loathed? I mean, I couldn't remember. But
yes, the one that you really loathed was Marcel Duchamp's piece, Erratum Musicale, where it was an early 1920s conceptual piece, and you couldn't make head nor tail of it, and you suggested something about using jam and dipping your finger in jam so that when you played keys on the piano, you could see what key you'd played, because there'd be a little jam mark on the piano.
Was that my idea?
That was your idea.
Oh, that's a fantastic idea.
I thought it was rather excellent. Yeah. And, perhaps slightly
trust me to bring
Duchamp's original idea, yeah.
Trust me to bring the world of preserves and jams into, tie it into
exactly.
Music.
It's,
you know?
it's very nice.
Of course, the Big Ears show has been immortalised on this CD release by the Sonic Arts Network. CD and booklet, which you put a great deal of work into. You're holding it there.
CD, booklet and poster. Very, very nearly sold out now, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, best get your orders in quickly, then.
Yeah, there's only about 900 copies left. And of course, the main thing about this was it was the first, what I believe to be the first republication of Fitzgerald's Broadcast Manifesto.
Yes, no.
In the new millennium. And I'm absolutely delighted to hear that some French and Italian disc jockeys have actually attempted to broadcast according to the principles of the manifesto, which brings me great joy, because I feel I've actually done a bit of a good service there. And if there's one thing to have come out of the show, I think what we've done is raise standards, certainly in some
standards
amongst the radio broadcasters, some of our European friends.
Sadly, not this one. I haven't even referred once to that manifesto since I started playing.
No, but
this
I am glad to see that as you are obeying manifesto principle 3.6,
which reads,
which states the broadcaster must dress in attire appropriate for any public speaking engagement. Usually, a shirt and tie will be required, although a jacket may temporarily be discarded on a humid day, granted the proviso that no guests are present in the studio.
Okay. Oh, well, I've actually lost my cufflinks here, so I've had to roll up my sleeves. So I apologise for that. Is there something from the Big Ears CD which we can enjoy right now?
Well, I'd really, I think it's worth having a listen to the pretentious Mystery Voice competition, especially since we're joined by a voice later on. I won't say it's pretentious or otherwise, but there's a lot of poets on this one.
Yeah.
And this was a compilation of a whole range of competitions that we had on the old show, but also draws on Fitzgerald's obsession with making lists. A little-known fact about Fitzgerald, he began making lists when he was a small boy and continued throughout his whole life. And this one, which is track 12 on
okay,
the CD,
just one second.
An attempt to make a list of voices, and we have 20 voices here. I know that we're in the studio with Rogan White now. So
indeed we are.
Pirate, so he will doubtless recognise most of the voices on this.
Okay, well, let's play this, and all three of us will have a very nice chat in a moment. This is Mystery Voice says...
One. Two.
If I told him.
Three.
He grows it tight.
Four.
My compositions.
Five.
Hello, boys.
Six.
Pat Mellon.
Seven.
The incredible thing is...
Eight.
And the metal position, but you earned it.
Nine.
I knew you'd like the enemy.
10. Ooh. 11.
The two poles of the creation.
12.
Dans l'Arabie des trois midi.
13.
An object.
14.
Derby.
15.
Mission.
16.
Every telling has a tailing.
17.
18.
Ah!
19.
20.
No. Poets don't own words.
There we had 20 mystery voices from the Big Ears CD produced by the Sonic Arts Network. Tim, yeah. I recognised many of those voices from the show. The Screaming Man, I noticed him.
Yeah, unknown Screaming Man. Amongst the others there, of course, there was Apollinaire, Kurt Schwitters, one of the more obvious ones on there, myself, Duchamp, E.E. Cummings.
What was the one that was my melancholy... That one.
That was E.E. Cummings.
Because that ran for many weeks on the show.
Weeks and weeks, rather surprisingly. At Hitler, he was in there. Raymond Scott, Tristan Zara, Gertrude Stein, Marinetti, all my favourite voices, in fact. As a list, something I enjoyed very much doing, compiling.
Yes.
Fitzgerald himself, as I was saying, I've been researching Fitzgerald now since I first rediscovered his manifesto in 1999. I've hooked up with his great, great grandniece.
Right.
I believe it is. Marjorie.
Is there such a thing as a grandniece?
His daughter. It's one removed. I don't know exactly what that is. It's one removed from being a daughter. So it's the, I think, his brother's great-great-great-granddaughter.
Okay.
Which is a great-great-grandniece. And she's she has the Fitzgerald archive. And going through that, we spent a lovely Sunday afternoon looking through some old papers and uncovered a folder full of lists that Fitzgerald had compiled in the tens and twenties as a young boy, all scrawled out. And this is rather a precursor to his obsession with orderliness and organisation of material for his radio show and for broadcasts.
What kind of lists did you find
he would list
with Marjorie?
He would list sandwiches that he'd had, drinks, places he'd been to, obviously lists of
places he'd come from.
The places he'd come from, I assume there wasn't a particular list like that that he'd done.
Right,
he
right.
He may well have done one. Obviously lists referring to all of his work and all of his broadcasts. And what excited me particularly about this was he just seems to be so ahead of his time, just in this kind of way. I mean, there's an obsession, certainly in England now, with lists, and there's books of lists, and lists of books of lists, and everyone seems obsessed with top 10 lists, top 100, top 1,000. You can't move for all of it. But Fitzgerald, as with so many things, was preempting this, you know, some 80, 90 years beforehand. So this has kind of got me onto lists, actually. More from that. So I've brought in a few of the lists that I've done, partly as a response to Fitzgerald's way. And it's rethink a lot.
What I'm particularly enjoying is the way that we've steered this from a kind of a discussion of Nam June Paik into basically just talking about you, like you making lists.
Well, I think
it's fair enough. I mean, let's face it. You know, we're irreconcilably differing on this whole music thing. You know,
the thing with the prove me wrong part of your show is that if there's anything,
it doesn't work.
If there's anything that your listeners have proved you, is that feature really doesn't work. I think the listeners have proved you wrong.
Cheers, Tim.
On the whole idea of that feature. If I were you, I'd ditch it for next week's show.
It is actually ditched for next week's show. Mainly,
the
Christmas
be.
Day show. It's ditched mainly because I haven't got time to get anyone in to record it. So you've brought in some lists,
yeah,
Tim.
I brought in some lists.
Thank you, and thank you for bringing in several tracks that are less than a minute long in order to kind of... Because I'm here on my own operating this desk for the first time, and you're really putting me through my paces.
Oh,
here.
You're doing very well.
Cheers. What are these lists, then? Shall I just play them?
Let's have list number three, first of all. Now, maybe I'll introduce this one. This is a list of status quo riffs. There's 10 status quo riffs, and I'm sure if there's any quo fans or people out there, they'll be able to identify all of them. But otherwise, let's just leave this one open and enjoy the quo riffs.
Okay. Oh, just a second. Now that I've said that...
Yeah, well, the thing is, you've
got
to
cue up
the track.
Okay,
yeah.
I'll cue up the track. Wait a second. Two, three. Fade that up, and then... Okay, here we go. Status quo riffs.
One. Two. Three. Four. Five. Six. Seven. Eight. Nine. Ten.
Ten status quo riffs put together by Tim Steiner, probably putting more work into that than to that sort of 1:30 section of the show than I've put into all the rest of it. So what were you trying to say with that? Oh, are we playing the game?
I'm not sure on that one. I'm not sure how good your awareness of the status quo riffs is. I mean, that came out of another track that was on the Big Ears album of the Ink Spot, Spotting the Ink Spot's riff. The Ink Spot's famous for Charlie Farquhar's introduction, which was identical, other than slight deviations in tonality and speed on each of the tracks. But otherwise, absolutely... the same, and I think the same thing with Quo, which is which you can hear just when you place them back to back. There, just that obsession with the shuffle beat that they've really made their own.
I just want to introduce Rogan Whitenails, who's come into the studio and will be performing later on. Just to bring him into the discussion officially, because otherwise it just feels a bit rude. It feels like we're talking to each other without including you. So I'm sorry about that. I noticed Whatever You Want in there.
Yes.
I noticed Rocking All Over the World was the last one.
Yes.
The thing is, I could just reel off some status quo hits, and I'd probably be right. Down, was that in there?
Yes, Down. That was okay. An easier one. We had The Wanderer.
The Wanderer.
Mean Girl, of course. What You're Proposing. I would have thought you'd have got that one. Paper Plane. Good Golly, Miss Molly. At number four, Good Old Time Rock and Roll. Number five, Whatever.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for that. What other lists have you brought in?
Because now, there's one that I think this is a one that you'll have a good, fair chance of doing. And Rogan, perhaps you want to join in with this. This is an A to Z of riffs. And this is a rock special, a guitar special, A to Z of riffs. I've compiled... a full alphabet of guitar riffs, if we have a listen to, and we'll perhaps see how many of these we can get.
Which track is this, Tim?
This will be track one.
Track number one. Here we are, with how many?
Well, it's the alphabet's worth.
An alphabet's worth of guitarists, my goodness me.
Yeah.
Enjoy.
A.
B. C. D. E. F. G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R,
S T U V W X Y Z.
That was it.
Well, that, yeah, it's the alphabet.
Oh yeah, that is the nothing comes after Z, does it?
No, not in my alphabet.
It went so fast.
Well,
I heard the police in there.
Yeah.
I stopped writing them down after a while. Harry Nilsson, I heard that.
Yeah.
Inks, there was an ink spot thing. Hendrix.
Yeah. I just had a riff. So I've been meaning to do it since I was about 11.
Right. And how long did it take you?
That's
a boring question.
I'm not even going to answer it.
Not worth answering.
No, I don't think it's. I don't think it's worth answering.
Why did you limit yourself with alphabets, with letters, rather than going on and on? Why not count to?
Well,
thousand.
Fitzgerald talks in a lot of detail about processes of ordering, and that. Yeah.
What was Fitzgerald's first name? You're being very
Charles.
Respectful. Charles. Did you ever refer to him as Charlie, or he wouldn't have appreciated that, would he?
No, he never went by the name of Charlie. It was okay. Charles Fitzgerald.
Fine.
Fitzgerald, he, with all of the processes of ordering that he had a real rationale for ordering those things. A chronology would be an obvious one. An alphabetical idea would be an obvious one as well. And also...
Asterisks. That's how I tend to do it when I'm sending emails. If I want to write a big list, and I'm not sure where it's going to go, this list. I use asterisks, yeah.
Well, Fitzgerald would have advised you to take that list and then to reorder it in a certain way. So it's like with the artist Claude Klosky, with his numbering of the first 1,000 numbers, he numbered them he arranged them alphabetically.
Yes.
So there you have them through numbers, which is a great way of ordering things, but alphabets is the other way, obvious way to do it. So
have you ever started a list and you're not sure where it's going to go, what the sort of parameters are for it, sort of free-floating list, so you're sort of listing things and then you start to see a pattern emerge?
Absolutely. It's when that pattern starts to emerge, then you have to revisit your list and you can go back to the start of it and reorder it in a completely different way, because open random lists can be slightly awkward and a little bit uncomfortable. Roger and myself, we had a list of from a feature called Link Ray that we used to do on the show, where you had to link Ray Manzarek from some wild and bizarre source, and there's another one of these in the book that we did, and I can't remember where we link it from in the Ray Manzarek. We went from Master of Futurism, Filippo Tommaso Marinetti, and we finally arrived back at Ray Manzarek. But for me, the list is slightly uncomfortable and imperfect, because the process of ordering is I feel randomer than I would have actually liked, certainly than Fitzgerald would have liked.
It's like being a liminoid, I guess, isn't it? Travelling somewhere, the actual travelling process is more satisfying than actually arriving, I suppose.
Well, on that one, it certainly was. The journey was good. We arrived there, and it was a little bit of an anticlimax. I suppose we always knew where we were going.
Did you have your jabs? Did you have your jabs?
Unfortunately not.
Tim, thank you for your list. Can we just finish by listening to the last one of these lists on this CD? What is this?
Yeah, this is a list of 21st notes.
21st notes. What do you mean?
They're just first notes of pieces of music.
Yes, okay.
So
well,
first notes.
Okay, here we are to end this magnificent section. 21st notes compiled by Tim Steiner.
1. 2 3 4 5 6 7 8 9 10 11 12 13 14 15 16 17 18 19 20
Tim, many thanks for that, and what are you doing later? Anything interesting?
Okay. Christmas shopping.
Excellent.
Thank you for having me.
No, not at all. Thanks to Tim Steiner, a man who influenced my radio presenting style far more than I would care to admit. One thing that Tim never did on his show, however, was to invite someone on every week to prattle on about issues pertaining to the world of sport. That's how I choose to stamp my individuality all over this programme, despite the fact that people do that thing all over commercial radio every day of the week. But none of them, so far at least, have used the insightful views of Mr. Steve Graziak.
Sir Alex Ferguson has come in for heavy criticism after comments he made in a 74-second long press conference during the week. In the conference, Ferguson alleged that the print media hated Manchester United and that they were trying to fragment the club, driving a wedge between the fans and the players. These are players, by the way, which fans are now no longer able to touch at their new training ground and get autographs from. Unless Martin Samuel and Brian Woolnough are now architects in their spare time, I don't think Fergie's tirade really stands up. In fact, Ferguson has now boycotted so many media outlets that the only publication he'll speak to is Family Circle. Lemon meringue pie recipe is rubbish. In cricket, fans of former Indian captain Sourav Ganguly reacted in a relatively muted manner to the news that their hero had been dropped from the Indian Test squad by burning effigies of the Indian chairman of selectors and team coach. This is by no means an isolated occurrence on the subcontinent, but this extreme method of protesting hasn't really spread to other parts of the world. Australian cricket fans once tried to burn an effigy of David Boone after a poor run of scores, but unfortunately they were a little too accurate with the likeness they constructed after filling it with 50 pints of Castlemaine 4X. The result made Hemel Hempstead look like a scout campfire. Ronnie O'Sullivan crashed out of the UK Snooker Championship last Saturday after another controversial display during his 9-8 loss to Mark King. During the match, O'Sullivan alternated between playing right and left-handed, sat with a wet towel over his head, was warned by the referee for conceding a frame too early, and now faces disciplinary action, failing to show up at a compulsory press conference after the match. In the World Championship a few years ago, he almost put himself out of the tournament by kicking a plant pot in anger after playing poorly during a session. Sport is now waiting to see if O'Sullivan will carry out his threat to leave snooker and join the American Pool Tour. I'd be more worried about him joining the WWE after all that. In horse racing, jockey Kieran Fallon snatched the prestigious Cathay Pacific Hong Kong Vase last Sunday on his horse Ouija Board. After the race, and all together now, Fallon was said to have taken his win in high spirit. Danny Williams captured the Commonwealth Heavyweight Boxing title last Saturday after beating Aubrey Harrison on a split points decision. In a dreadful bout that showed Harrison to be about as adept at boxing as my pet guinea pig, fans taunted the former Olympic gold medalist with chants of "what a load of rubbish," and even left before the end of the bout, despite some of them having fought at over £200 per ticket. He blamed the defeat on hurting his hand in round two after he landed a punch. Well, presumably his hands are so used to missing that they couldn't deal with the trauma. And finally, in tennis, the raft of comebacks that started with John McEnroe and Martina Hingis recently continues, with Monica Seles dropping her biggest hint yet that she will make a return to the sport soon. Her announcement has sped up plans by the WTA to issue umpires with earplugs during the matches. Now, I mean, this leads me on to a thought I was having during the week, Rodri, about sports broadcasts
okay.
that are so loud that they actually make you turn the sound off. I mean, I'm talking about the participants here, and I think Monica Seles is the only one I can think of that has actually made me turn the sound off because she's that annoyingly loud during her matches.
Yeah, it's difficult. But obviously, there aren't many sports where where the actual utterances of the participants themselves actually play any part in the game. Obviously, there's plenty of examples of commentators who you switch off immediately.
Oh yeah, well, Rod Atkinson was the one I was thinking of in particular. I mean, now he's not on ITV anymore. I think that's about the best thing that's happened to football ever. I think
the only time I really turn the sound down ever on my TV is when I'm embarrassed. But then I also turn my head away from from the screen, so it doesn't really count. I could just turn the whole set off. Quickly, some non-league headlines for you. Surrey quits Fleet for Basingstoke. Tamworth complete Nielsen signing. Northampton loan Hicks to Hitchin, and Inglethorpe stalls on Exeter deal. Any thoughts on those?
Well, as for the Exeter deal, I mean, the only thing I really know about Exeter was when United played him in the FA Cup. I think it was last season. And Exeter actually managed to take United to a replay, which was part of the most depressing thing that's happened to a United fan the last couple of years.
So you're saying that it's wrong for me really to bracket them with Northampton, Hitchin, Tamworth, Fleet and Basingstoke?
Maybe Hitchin. The rest of them, fair enough. But Hitchin, I think, might be stretching it a little bit too far.
Steve, thank you for ringing in today. Have you ever been to Sweden?
I've never been to Sweden, no.
Okay, well, one group of men who definitely has been to Sweden, or definitely have been to Sweden because they live there, is Bob Hund. There we had the irascible Swedes Bob Hunt with the song En Pratstund from the album Omslag Martin Kan, a truly wonderful album in stark contrast to their others, which are, almost without exception, pretty rubbish. So if you're investing in Bob Hunt, for God's sake, make sure you buy the right one. By contrast, a man noted for his constant consistency is Mr. Neil Scott, who has been provoking much earnest discussion in the pubs of Britain over the past 6 weeks, and some pretty intense shouting in clubs where, of course, they play the music much louder. Here he is again with his thought for, he said, queuing it up, the week.
This week on the reality TV programme Space Cadets, three people were shown that what they had thought was the most significant experience of their lives was, in actual fact, a sham. The irredeemable Johnny Vaughan offered scant consolation by saying that he was jealous of them for having had the belief that they had been up in space. Despite being incredibly gullible, his words didn't wash. Unfortunately, the value of their time as cosmonauts was almost completely tied to the meaning of the experience, not the experience itself. One could see them anticipating the pleasure they'd get telling their mates down the pub, and all of this was shattered in an instant. The truth is that we don't live in the moment, and probably never have. It is the context that gives life its flavour. Take Christmas, a festival that is full of context. How easy it is to view it as a depressing cycle of commercial exploitation and drunken insincerity. And yet, with a little optimism, much fun can be had. Happy Christmas, listeners.
For a pleasant Sunday afternoon, why don't you tune to Time Wasting with Audrey Marsden on Resonance FM.
Many thanks to Neil Scott with a slightly early Christmas wish for us there. Now, if you bear with me, I don't have my regular engineer, Jamie, in with me today, and he's just not turned up, and I'm wondering why. Apparently he had a gig last night and he might still be drunk, but 1 second. Right, it's time for another tune from Hungary, or as the Hungarians know it, Magyar or Szeg. It's a country that's been disproportionately represented in this series, with this being, what, the second Hungarian record in 3 weeks. But I make no apology for this. After all, you can choose your friends, but you can't choose your record collection. From the album Eye of the Needle, this is Kempetz Dolores.
Nevárja, nincs mit a félni, lesz egy fokani óra.
Campets Dolores there with Erdogan, and try saying Erdogan to a stranger in a bar repeatedly for 30 seconds. I can tell you right now that it doesn't go down at all well. But now it's time to welcome our last live guest of the series into the show, because next week it's Christmas Day, and try getting people to volunteer to perform, or indeed listen to a low-budget radio station on the day of the birth of our Lord Jesus Christ. Anyway, today we're very lucky to have with us in the studio poet and musician Rogan Whitenails.
Gravity ceasing suddenly worsened when Norma had our baby in July. The baby vomited into my speakers and I, after letting it dry, poked a toothpick through the quiggly guy to clean away the regurgitated bristmilk. To clean away the regurgitated breast milk. To clean away the regurgitated breast milk. To clean away the regurgitated breast milk.
This story is just about Gretel. Hansel, it seems, does not have the metal or the time or some lame excuse. It begins as the midwife starts to induce labour. Peristaltic breadcrumbs settle in the birth canal, and Gretel begins to follow the trail. And so I retell the fairy tale with Hansel on leave and gas and air to relieve the pain. Once there fell a great dearth on a godless elsewhere sphere, and gravity was led to earth and cruelly abandoned here, brought to this world from some other realm. In the fairy tale by Wilhelm and Jacob Grimm, Hansel leaves a trail to retrace, but gravity opted absurdly to skim her pebbles along the surface of space, unburdening herself the silly oaf before she had even set out. And although she remembered to take a loaf, she scattered her breadcrumbs about far too wide. And when she was left on earth, she cried, for she realized her mistake, and the world began to ache under the weight of her clasps. I hear the dulcet gasps of people falling upwards. Everything leaves the earth, nothing sticks. Gretel, who had been pressing on the cervix, falls upwards and is borne through the crown of my wife's head. And my wife, probably dead, trails behind in her dressing gown. The shards of her punctured crown cut into Gretel's feet. But at once, the blood is dry, and everyone in the delivery suite, my wife, Gretel, the midwife, and I, is decanted into outer space at an imponderable pace. We leave behind the terra firma, and having suffered with baroterma, tismophobia since childhood, being constantly told that gravity could never possibly cease, now that it's finally vacated, oh, the release. I feel vindicated. The earth is deciduous after all, and we are its leaves, except we fall upwards come the season. So, what can be the reason? Why has gravity left our planet? To go back home, how can it? No pebble was dropped and every crumb was thrown astray. He who abandoned gravity has come back to collect the castaway, to lead her back to the dimension from whence she came, causing this cataclysmic ascension. Now, I suppose you might claim that gravity is a universal law. Being everywhere all over at once, it is omnipresent. Therefore, to say it could ever ensconce on our earth alone is a falsehood. Beyond the grove of our neighbourhood, gravity is a babe lost in the wood of ubiquity, if lost at all. But the thrust of my objection is, how is it possible to fall? upwards, downwards, or in any direction once gravity has gone, when falling itself is dependent on this universal law, and when in fact falling is just another word for gravitational force. Like autumn, of course, is another word for fall. Oh, why be so quizzical? Thoughts, though very, very small, are physical. And the fact my wife was able to fall upwards in your imagination, at least, means she did. And gravity ceased, and that is why she fell. Okay? Okay? The Earth yields its impedimenta, and we are no longer seeking the centre in accordance with the centripetal force. We fall upwards, and the course we follow through space is lined with the kind of hairs you find on a nettle, though we slide upwards from the underside, avoiding getting stung. We see strange, torpid stars among the other stars in the cosmos. Matte stars, lacking gloss. And the midwife tells me that those are the itchy white hives that arose through brushing against the nettle. We fall upwards, following Gretel, delivered and exalted, dressed in the rags of her afterbirth. And the canyons of heaven are filled with the salted waters uprooted from earth.
Praise be to Rogan Whitenails there, and he'll be back with more beautiful word-based entertainment for us in about 15 minutes' time. A couple of weeks ago, I ended up seeing a quite incredible show called Good Morning Psychic on the depressingly named UTV2 Extra channel. Adele was the chirpy presenter, thrilled at getting her foot on the TV ladder, not realising that the number of rungs has increased dramatically in the past few years, and she may never get further than extolling the virtues of a five-day break in Thassos on TV Travel Shop. With her, we have Daphne. Daphne claims to be a psychic. She's serious about her predictions and gives short shrift to anyone who dares doubt her. Those people who think that it's all a load of hocus-pocus, she says, looking sternly into the camera, can think again. This is very, very magical. It's certainly compulsive viewing. Viewers ring in and leave messages on a voicemail system, which are then replayed in the studio, thus avoiding the embarrassing possibility of someone screaming, "Lies! Lies! It's all lies!" Questions may vary from, "I have a blister on my foot. Will I die?" to, "Does the girl who was just working in accounts like me?" No further details are forthcoming from the callers. No name, age, socio-economic, leisure class, nothing. But that doesn't deter Daphne. She shuffles her pack of cards in a clumsy fashion and lays out four or five of them on the table in front of her, out of our sight, and uses the information gleaned from these cards to predict the future. "Can you tell me if me and my girlfriend will marry?" asks one man. "Will her four-year-old boy come to look at me as a father?" Daphne is pleased to discover the "Happy Ever After" card and the "Dreams Coming True" card have both shown up in the hand she has dealt, and she holds them up to prove it to us all. These particular two cards show up with unerring frequency throughout the programme. No "Trampled by Herd of Cattle" card. No "Oh no, immersed in bathtub of effluent" card. She passes on positive energies to the caller, assuring him, or even assuring him, that everything will be just fine. "But if you'd like a proper reading, maybe call me this afternoon," she adds. An 0906 premium rate telephone number is on the screen constantly, reminding you that you're one step and a crippling phone bill away from having your destinies revealed. Adele really wishes that she was on a Saturday morning kids show on the BBC, and who can blame her? She tries some chatty banter with us, the viewers. "Now, I'm sure you're all comfy at home there, tucked up in bed with your gym jams on," but Daphne interrupts with cacophonous laughter. "Oh, it's so true, isn't it? You do, don't you? Wear gym jams on a Sunday. Oh, Adele, we're not letting you out of the studio. You're too good." Fear flashes across Adele's face at the notion of being trapped forever in an episode of Good Morning Psychic. But she regains her composure to read out a message that has been sent in from a woman with a headache. "I have a headache," reads the message. It's time for Daphne to exercise her healing powers. "I feel that you've had an abandonment program that has been running for several hundred lifetimes," she says casually, a sentence which makes my head spin and my lungs fight for air. Say 300 lifetimes, average age of, what, 50 or so? That's, what, 15,000 years that this poor woman has been suffering. Daphne then attempts to reverse this seemingly irreversible trend by demonstrating some cleaning, i.e. absentmindedly swinging a lump of crystal backwards and forwards. "Now, I also want you to try and think with the left-hand side of your brain," says Daphne. I try and meet this challenge myself, as I also have a slight headache. It's quite difficult. I turn the left part of my head towards the screen and I focus, but my head hurts even more. Daphne's advice isn't working. She deals out four cards and pulls out the Happy Ever After and Dreams Coming True cards, like rabbits from a hat. Thank God, we're all going to be okay. She urges everyone to always move forward. It becomes the mantra of the show. Always, always move forward. Never enter some kind of time slip wormhole. Never do that. Always continue to live, obeying the regular elapsing of minutes and seconds. If you concentrate, it can be done. Let's not confuse the energies, though. Clear and balance our chakras with jade, for example. Daphne advises a girl about to take her driving test to wear some brown shoes. "I'm giving you brown shoes," she lies, having no access to a spare pair of brown shoes in the correct size, and indeed no forwarding address for the caller. Brown shoes will apparently ground her, stop her spinning off into space, perhaps, shoes that obey the law of gravity. Probably sensible, but in case there's any doubt, you can always call Daphne after the show for a price. Marie ends the show with a cry of despair, barked frantically from her Birmingham flat. "I want to know if I'm going to have a relationship," she says, before replacing the receiver. In a rare moment of lucidity, Daphne suggests that Marie is unlikely to have a relationship unless she moves forward. Move forward, Marie. Move forward by refusing to give any money to these exploitative, talentless, mercenary imbeciles. I hope that helps, my love. From the album Surfing with the Kenny Process Team, here are, unsurprisingly, the Kenny Process Team.
And now it's time to take a trip down Politics Lane with Andrew Ward, who will be painting a picturesque political landscape.
Hello, Rodri. And in a week which began with further revelations about the controversial CIA practice of extraordinary rendition, continuing race riots in Sydney, the discovery of a Baghdad detention centre where prisoners had been tortured, and clashes outside the World Trade Organization summit in Hong Kong, I'm starting this week with the surprise claim that Andrew Neil, the frizz-haired presenter of BBC4's The Daily Politics, had been seen in a Soho club dancing with shock rock star Marilyn Manson. According to Times journalist Hugo Rifkind, Mr. Neil, 56, was spotted in the Cuckoo Club last Saturday, dancing side by side with Mr. Manson, 36, to the tune of Let's Stick Together by Brian Ferry, 60. However, Mr. Neil immediately denied the report, writing in to say that while he may have been in the Cuckoo Club on the night in question, he merely had a quick nightcap and did not dance with Marilyn Manson, adding, I have no idea who she is and have no acquaintance with anybody of that name. Enjoying more than a quick nightcap was former Labour MP and Education Minister Stephen Twigg, who was arrested and fined £50 after drinking too much red wine at the Foreign Policy Centre's Christmas lunch. Mr. Twigg, 39, who famously won Michael Portillo's Enfield Southgate seat in the 1997 general election, was spotted by a police officer when he fell over after leaving the restaurant, whose name he can't remember. Another MP known to enjoy a drink is Liberal Democrat leader Charles Kennedy, who is left fighting to save his position as party leader following criticism of his leadership style by senior Lib Dem figures. Mr. Kennedy, 46, was defended by wonky-faced asteroid obsessive Lembit Opik, who said that MPs who gave anonymous briefings to the press were cowards. Mr. Opik, 40, is well known for his campaigns against asteroids and had previously warned of the dangers posed by an asteroid called 2002 NT7, whose orbit could lead it to collide with the Earth on the 1st of February 2019. I may sound like one of those guys who walks up and down with a sandwich board saying the end of the world is nigh, said Mr. Opik, but the end is nigh. I have said for years that the chances of this asteroid having an impact which could wipe out most of the human race is 100%. It would cause earthquakes, fires, a nuclear winter, and tidal waves, which would obliterate 7 out of every 10 living things on the planet. Dr. Donald Yeomans of the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California told BBC News Online, the error in our knowledge of where NT7 will be on the 1st of February 2019 is large. Several tens of millions of kilometers. It's a very close call, said Mr. Opik. Scientist Alan Fitzsimmons from the National Space Center in Leicester estimated that the odds against the collision were 60,000 to 1. There is a good chance this particular object won't hit us, said Mr. Opik. Finally, any roundup of the week in politics which failed to mention the Iraqi elections would be rightly dismissed as being shallow and frivolous. Rodri, do you think my roundup is shallow and frivolous?
It's shallow and frivolous every single week, which is I think what gives it its unique flavour.
It's what the listeners want.
I'm not sure it's what they want, but it's what I want, and that's what counts, because...
It's what they're getting.
It certainly is. It's been a terrible week for Charles Kennedy. Do you feel any sympathy for the moon-faced ginger liberal?
I think you have to feel some sympathy for the pint-sized carrot top Lib Dem leader, Charles Kennedy.
I'm always confused by this phrase that they use in these kind of situations, which they say put up or shut up. I don't really understand what it means. Does it mean put up with me or shut up, or what does it mean?
It's a bit of jar. I wouldn't expect you to understand it, Roger. It's quite complex, and I think it'll take. Perhaps when we've finished, I can explain it to you in very, very simple terms.
How long will it take?
Any normal person, maybe 25 seconds or so. I'd do, you know, half an hour.
That's very, very kind of you. The reassuring sight of John Prescott travelling to Hemel Hempstead to reassure the locals. Did you have any thick black smoke billowing over your Brighton Bijou residence?
No.
Right, okay. Has there been any massive explosions near you recently?
No.
Have you ever been to Hemel Hempstead?
I've been to Bedfordshire. Does that count? I think I've been to... isn't there an airport there?
There is. At Luton, yeah.
Yeah, you're from Dunstable, aren't you?
Yeah.
How's Dunstable bearing up?
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
The Stephen Twiggs story, I think I'll have to take some of the blame for that, because he was drinking red wine, and if you remember, last week you asked me if I had any wine recommendations, and I did suggest red wine under the other one, which I believe is white wine.
Well, it's possible Twig was listening and just heard your recommendation, went out to his local vintners, as you suggested, and just bought several hundred bottles of the stuff. But
my influence is frightening.
It is.
The power that I wield.
Lastly, in the week in politics, the EU budget, and particularly the British rebate. Obviously, that's something that affects us all. So, Andrew, where will you be spending Christmas?
Just out scavenging in bins.
Scavenging in bins.
Yeah, it's just a traditional.
Are things that bad? Are you going to be doing anything else at Christmas?
I'll be in the Cuckoo Club dancing with Andrew Neil and Marilyn Manson.
Excellent. All right, Andrew, I've just realised something, which is that I haven't played a single record by a black artist since this series started.
Well, you are notorious racist.
No, that's not true. But don't you think I ought to kind of pathetically try and remedy this situation somehow?
I think the CRE would demand it.
Okay, this is Smiley Culture.
Every time I drive, me car police a stop me so fast. Through me drive a Fiat and a Mercel with me Lancia. Some more time I'm gonna ease and I'm fi check some Cockney. Them a tell produce insurance license and emoti, but me say police officer no give me producer. Police officer no bother give me producer. Police officer no give me producer. Police officer no bother give me producer. To everybody in the downtown, I dedicate this style. Whether you are lawbreaker or you are informer, you could be a PCCID. Or a inspector. Me no charge for murder. Fend to produces where me charge for. So police officer no give me producer. Police officer no bother give me producer. Cause me a smiley culture. I'm used to drive up a Lancia. And me a drive car from me a teenager. Police officer me is a expert driver. So if you see me say no shout or no holler. No stand up in the road with a torch and try pull me over. Cause if it's a dark night myself you will get run over. No come behind me the road and start flash your flasher. I'll come rev it beside me pan your scooter. Come is a man who woulda just drive faster. And when me feel like it, me woulda pull up on a corner. Before you ask any question, me already have an answer. And any answer you get me one, you know it would be farmland. So police officer no give me producer. Police officer no bother give me producer. Police officer no give me producer. Police officer no bother give me producer. I'm where your people's club me pass through Victoria. And through me a entertainer say no tax from me window. As me go through the lights, the whole road take over. And as me drive near, I could see clear I was a black Mariah. With 6 and 7 plainclothes police officer. Them didn't look the type of police me could give a fiver. First thing that come into my head, good thing me hide my ganja. Next thing that happened, them waving, in other words, pull me over. I'm a could I do is sigh and shrug me shoulder. And as them approach me, start wind down me window. Me I go tell you how me answer. Every question them fire. What's the name, son? My name's Smiley Culture. Yeah, where do you think you're coming from, lad? From seeing my mother. What's the registration number of the card? And I can't remember. What you got in the evidence, son? I can't say Ricardo. Would you like to have a look? Shy bloody man, if we ask you answer. Now take the keys out of the car and step out of the motor. Me and my colleagues have got a few questions to ask ya. You'll be on your way as soon as we get an answer. As me come out to the camera, think of me, I wonder. What police officer could want with Smiley Culture? With them touch, them a search the interior. But whatever them looking for, me hiding place superior. But the way them a search me hand to ask them what them a look for. But me try handle them cause them just handle me closer. Then one draw anchor put him on palm me shoulder and say, we ain't got no time, why we don't think you have neither. Just give us what we want, the real sense in mania. Me never had no chance, me draw out me ganja. As me do that, them start rub them on together. One say, should we put me in the van or in the back of the Rover? Me say, you can't do that, come in name Smiley Culture. You what did you do that record? Cockney translator. In a reggae chance number one was its number. Our kids love it and so does my mother. Tell you what I'll do, a favour for a favour. Just sign your autograph on this piece of paper. Me cut in shot and me just draw out me Parker. And the producer me just sign Smiley Culture. Them never lie, them never bother. Arrest me or take me ganja.
Smiley Culture there from 1984 says something about the ignorance of the BBC that Relaxed by Frankie Goes to Hollywood could be banned in that same year for oblique references to sex, whereas Police Officer, a tale of a policeman catching a singer with drugs and then letting him off when he realised that he's semi-famous, would get widespread airplay. Anyway, enough. Now it's time to welcome back Rogan Whitenails for another delicious performance.
This poem's called The Caudal Appendage and Hemorrhoids. Tried a hot bath, more fibre, taking my overdue books back to the library. Nothing has worked, and it's been 2 days now. Oh, where the sun don't shine. Overdue and a terrible fine. Avoid all hemorrhoidal bleeding. Take your books back after reading. Take them back. Renew your loan. A lump emerged as big as the bone that protrudes at the base of my spine, rendering me supine with knees aloft, wide apart, and now it hurts to fart more than hitherto known. A lump as big as my tailbone with blood, so bright, almost pink. A lump the size of the missing link, the size of the bone where a primate's tail had tethered itself to a hay bale, rather than climb beyond the time when we evolved and borrowed books. The monkey's hay bale looks so comfortable in my mind. My books were late and I was fined. Extinction's healing void would surely soothe my hemorrhoid. Dodos flying, never landing, library fines are still outstanding. If I sat on extinction's bale, I know that soon, like the tail that evolution docked, my coccyx, usually easily knocked, usually sour and petrified and routinely made to hide beneath my pants under a label, would loosen and be able to swish and ripple gracefully. Let something else evolve, not me. A bookish, thrombotic droid, emerging in time like a hemorrhoid, straddling the dolphin's fin. Insert a finger, pop me back in. Let me sit on this bale, my brain like the bone where a primate's tail once wagged as its hands dragged on the floor. Leave me behind, my bottom is sore. With a stern shush in the reading room, I see another hemorrhoid loom like a comet with a tail of sparks. And the mildew of studious bite marks on the plastic arms of my glasses glistens beneath my hair as it passes. I study for what? A distinction. And all I crave is extinction. Make me endangered then, make me gone. The tail I had, like the neck of a swan, fell on its wings, grew shorter, then dived for something under the water, extended deep, then dissolved. And so my body evolved without a tail, without grace. And now I feel compelled to chase another morsel of sinking bread. Let me dissolve in the riverbed. No more a biped, nor erect, no longer sore, no longer pecked by my coccyx madly, under a label cut out badly so the jagged washing instructions remain to prickle and scratch. Oh, let me crane my neck to chase the sinking bread. Let me dissolve in the riverbed. The bale looks soft, but might its hay scratch me in a similar way to how the label does now? I crave extinction, but exactly how, where I sit and what on, will make the difference when I am gone. Luxuriously extinct, when my tender coccyx has slinked away from the base of my spine, I will find a comfortable place to recline. Endangered, in limbo, extinct, limber. Felling the fins of sharks, timber. I kneel in the path of the toppling fin, hoping the impact will pop me back in as the fin spanks my rear end. Where the fin had stood, light will descend and seedling fish will thrive. Oh, why did my tail not survive? Car Cox, the girlfriend of Rupert Brooke, had a coccyx that people mistook for a tail, it hung so loosely. And while she secretly prayed profusely that her tail would some day shrivel, the poet secretly wished his muse could grow it, for he knew its power. And he climbed to the top of the library tower in Cambridge by the River Cam and shouted to Carr, "From where I am, I can see the tails in the city of Ely. But none are as loose, none swish freely. They climb the cathedral like vines." He returned his books and paid his fines. Gotta go, Cat got gut rot. The vicarious kicks that he got from Carcox's coccyx are in taste quite poor. Leave me behind, my bottom is sore. A shower curtain of sharks, a tea-cosy T-Rex, the mildew of studious bite marks on the plastic arms of my specs glistens beneath my hair, shines through, and the ice axe placed adjacent to the Yeti's footprint for scale was once a twirling, limber tail. But no more. Leave me behind, my bottom is sore. so flimsy now without their fins. A shower curtain of sharks begins to hug my back as I stay kneeling, its clinging transparency revealing the gargoyle of my coccyx behind. Naked and shampoo blind, I long to hear the clatter of rings sliding along as extinction slings the shower curtain aside, and the ligature applied to my hemorrhoid, tied tightly, would also be used to strangle me. And when we drop off, the world will be raw. Leave me behind. My bottom is sore. Where the sun don't shine, it will set, and black salubrious sweat will flow again beneath the pleats in my anus. And Keats should have made the distinction. Fully in love with easeful extinction is greater than half with death, it seems. Tell me the meanings of my dreams and why Darwin and Freud, so anally retentive, never pondered the hemorrhoid, how it provides an incentive to be extinct. For these two factors are linked, like the coccyx and the tail. A ode to Florence Nightingale, the wounded in war. Leave me behind, my bottom is sore. On 104.4 and on the World Wide Web, it's Resonance
FM. Many, many thanks to Rogan Whitenails there. And that brings us to the end of the last live time-wasting radio show. Because honestly, you don't expect me to turn up next week, do you? There are presents to be opened, for goodness sake. Turkey to be chewed, cranberry sauce to be spilt, avocado to be gently pushed to one side, and a glut of really, really dreadful television to be steadfastly ignored. So next week's Christmas special show will be pre-recorded, ladies and gentlemen, but will be on at midday if your family are driving you stark staring mad that you feel the need to get away from it all and lose yourself in the wonderful world of Resonance FM. Thanks again to Tim Steiner for coming into the studio earlier, and to regular contributors Neil Scott, Andrew Ward and Steve Graziak. To end this week's show, another record from 1984, for no other reason than I arranged my records chronologically, and this one popped out, stuck to this Smiley Culture record with a vintage piece of Wrigley's Juicy Fruit. The Art of Noise blew my mind as a 13-year-old boy. I couldn't conceive of a piece of music consisting solely of drums and very little else. I mean, my God, I hadn't even heard of Edgar Varese at that stage. This 12-inch single I'm about to play is particularly brutal, punctuated with shrill screaming, as if they knew that the kind of torture my mother went through every time I played it. So excuse the crackles, it's a well-loved bit of vinyl. Next up, I think, is Tom Chivers, with more poetry than you can shake a sceptre at. My name's Rodri Marsden, and I don't really arrange my records chronologically. And right now, I'm going to a mince pie and sherry party. Goodbye.